Hi, this is Nancy Clare. Welcome to episode 22 of Speaking of Mysteries. This week's guest is Laurie R. King, creator of the Mary Russell Sherlock Holmes Mysteries, as well as the series featuring San Francisco-based police detective Kate Martinelli, and the so far two-volume Stuyvesant and Gray series, as well as the anthologies of Holmes and Watson stories, written by contemporary writers that she edits alongside Speaking of Mysteries co-creator Leslie Klinger. In fact, I pretty much sat back and went along for the ride as these two old friends talked about what it means to be a writer, the role of editors, Arthur Conan Doyle, and ocean voyages in the third decade of the 20th century. The interview is on the long side, but I mean, how could I in good conscience deprive listeners of more Laurie R. King?
You've been on our hit list for a long time, Laurie.
I am pleased to know I'm on somebody's hit list.
We very much wanted to have you on the show because all of our fans are fans of yours.
So. Yay, she's awesome.
Awesome, exactly. We ought to start with the basics for some who are new to your work. It's hard to believe this is the 20th anniversary of Beekeeper's Apprentice, but Beekeeper's was not your first book.
Well, yes and no. It was the first book I wrote, but it was the second book that got published for various reasons. And as it worked out, I think that was probably fine. But the first book that I wrote was indeed... The Beekeeper's Apprentice, which was at the time called On the Segregation of the Queen, which you may recognize where that comes from.
Yes, I've heard that phrase before.
Yes, little bells. But yes, it was A Grave Talent was the one that was the one that the publishers bought first, although it was not the first I wrote. I think Grave Talent was the third one that I wrote, but
You won the Edgar for best first novel. So fortunately, it came out first. If it had come out second, it wouldn't have been eligible.
No, and I don't think The Beekeeper's Apprentice would have won best first novel, because if you notice, there aren't a whole lot of what are regarded as pastiches that get nominated for prizes.
I think that's true. With few exceptions, yes. So I feel compelled to ask the question, why did you do it? What drove you to write? There you were, you had young children. I know you were desperate to get away from being a childcare person 24/7.
Yeah, I think that an awful lot of people start writing in order to escape into a nice, controllable world. When you have small children, the world is not controllable. But fiction, I was under the delusion at the time that fiction would be controllable. I soon learned otherwise, but by that time I was already addicted. I think that the reason I started with the Sherlockian element of the book was that I was interested in how that kind of mind works, and to look at how it works apart from the person that it's attached to, you need to look at it in a different setting. So thinking of that mind as a young female 20th century individual rather than a Victorian male gave me a lot of way of playing with what does it mean to see all kinds of things that other people don't. And for being a young mother at the time, I saw a lot of things and astonished my children. You know, how do you do it, Holmes? You can see that your kid ate the cookies before dinner because he's not eating dinner. I needed a little chorus in the background of Watson saying, how do you do it, Laurie?
Now, you had come, I think, really relatively straight out of an academic background at that point.
Yeah. I finished my master's in Old Testament theology in 84. And I sat, when my son was one, and I sat down to write Beekeeper in 87. So he was just starting preschool. He was in his first year of preschool. So I had just, what was it, three glorious mornings a week to myself. And so I decided that's what I wanted to do with them, was not do the dishes and scrub the floors, but write a book.
So you were an overnight success, a mere 7 years from beginning to publication.
Yes, yes, an overnight success. The first one came out in 1993. Beekeeper came out in 94, so it was 7 years.
They're wildly different, Grave Talent and Beekeepers. I mean, they're almost like different genre. Was that intentional? You felt like you had different muscles you wanted to try out, or?
Yeah, part of it was just the kind of story I was telling. I had written two in the Russell series, the Beekeeper's Apprentice, and the one that turned out to be the third one, A Letter of Mary. And I had an idea for a book that was about, in effect, a woman Rembrandt. What would Rembrandt look like if Rembrandt were female? And that kind of idea didn't really grow in the kind of whimsical world of Rosalind Holmes. So I transplanted the idea into my end of the century, my part of the world, that is San Francisco, and came up with a woman cop. So as I said, was by chance the first one published. Beekeeper was the next, and the one after that was another Martinelli, another one in the contemporary series, with a holy fool who wanders around San Francisco. So by that time, my poor publishers were so confused about what is it that Laurie King does. The following book, they had a flyer that they gave out to their sales department at the top of which said, "What Laurie King will do next is always a mystery." to sort of pick up on those reviews that said, "We're not really sure if this is the same Laurie King, but it..." So yes, you are right. They are very different books.
Are you getting a lot of pressure at this point to turn back to Martinelli, or...?
Only from readers.
Of course.
Martinelli has some devoted readers, and I would like to do another novel or perhaps a series of novellas that I at least publish as ebooks. We sort of have to see how much time my contractual obligations are taking up, but I would like to do that.
Do you think that you're going to add another volume to the City of Bones series?
Yeah. Touchstone was the first one. The second one is set 3 years later, and I sort of envision that Stuyvesant and Gray series as probably five books altogether set between the wars. I'd like to do one in Spain, and Berlin has become so much of a cliche, it's very difficult to write about Berlin between the wars without writing about the same things. But there's a lot of interesting stuff going on throughout Europe during that period. So yes, there will be more in that series.
One of the problems that I hear from writer friends all the time is the pressure from publishers to write a book just like their last book, except different.
Yeah.
Do you feel you're dealing successfully with that in the sense that you're making yourself happy by switching around? And I mean, clearly you have not succumbed to the pressure to do Russell, 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 which is what Random House would like you to do.
Yeah, it's always a golden trap, isn't it, when you do something that people respond to by buying the book. you know, it makes it possible to keep a roof over the head. On the other hand, there are stories that cannot be told in that universe, and so I always need to say to the publisher, yes, you can have a Russell, but you also need to include in the contract a non-Russell. So that's the position I'm in at the moment. I have actually found Random House extremely supportive and generous with me. For one of the big publishing houses, and for me a relatively small cog in the wheel, they have been very supportive of my desire to do different things.
You've done nonfiction books as well. We might mention your book on writing that you edited.
crime and thriller writing, which was a whole lot of fun. It was a series of explorations into how to do this job that we do. And one of the most interesting parts to me as a reader of the book, rather than as an author of the book, was the 26 writers that did guest essays in the thing. So that was a lot of fun. As you probably know, Les, I enjoy editing.
I've noticed that. At least you've been willing to be pushed into it from time to time, yes.
Yeah, I've really loved the two Sherlock books that we've done. They've been fun in unexpected ways. I mean, the sorts of ways that people think of to tell the stories about that character are fascinating to me.
Me too. I mean, I must say I'm not a great reader in general of short stories. I appreciate them, but I don't regularly read short stories. And to see the differences, every story, Laurie and I are speaking now of the collections, and we should, I guess, actually plug them. One called A Study in Sherlock that came out from Random House in 2011, and one coming out from Pegasus Books in November, called In the Company of Sherlock Holmes. I don't think that so all told between those, we have over 30 stories, quote, inspired by the Sherlock Holmes canon. There are no two alike. They all go in such fascinatingly different directions, styles, eras, etc. And it's just the sheer virtuosity of those writers that has been exciting to me.
What I found fascinating with those was some of the stories you could identify immediately as to their writer. There was no doubt, and it didn't even need to be a familiar character such as Michael Connelly's story. There's a Harry Bosch character, and so you know who wrote that. But there are other stories that are the opposite, and you get to the end and you think, I would not have guessed in 100 years that was written by, and there were two or three different people in there. I think it's the same sort of thing that people must think when they finish one of my non-Russell books, because they're very familiar with a series, and then they read a Martinelli or they read A Darker Place or one of the Stuyvesant and Gray. And it's a whole different face to a writer, and I think that's one of the pleasures in a collection like this that both Les and I found, is that it enables writers to work different muscles and to be different people.
I think that's what's been the appeal to those who we've gotten to contribute, is just sort of, Laurie's always described it as playing in our sandbox. And I think that that's been tremendously appealing to some of the contributors, is a chance to just sort of go, whoopee, I don't have to write about my character. I'll mention, for example, I don't have to write about V.I. Warshawski. I can write something that no one in a million years would guess was a story by me.
Yeah. And pet areas. Any writer has a collection of things that they just really, really love the idea of working in that area, but it just doesn't fit the series that you're working in or even a standalone. And you can see that with a number of the writers, and I'm thinking of the one on Dunkirk.
Yes, I was thinking the same one.
You know, this is a passion, clearly, but didn't fit into any of his novels.
And in the last collection, a story about the McKinley assassination.
Yeah.
That was just completely out of left field as far as the writer, something identifiable with the writer, clearly something that the author was passionate about, and it turned out to be a fascinating story.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to ask a question of the two of you. You are the two people who brought the suit against the Conan Doyle estate.
Well, now wait a minute. That's not entirely true. The suit.
Laurie's innocent.
I was a co-editor of the book that triggered the suit, but I am happy to back Les in this, but he ran with it all the way, so I really shouldn't get credit for any of it.
No, Lori's being much too modest, but she's we've tried to keep her, you know, being a lawyer, it was okay for me to come across as a nasty, ugly litigant. We decided that Lori was a lady and shouldn't dirty her hands with this kind of a case.
Oh, yeah.
But can I ask, what do you think this means to books like In the Company of Sherlock Holmes going forward?
Well, I think it's obvious that it's going to remove some of the more irritating assertions. But I don't know that it will make a huge amount of difference long term for the number of books. What do you feel, Les?
I agree. I think that it's not going to suddenly be an upsurge of Sherlockian pastiche that hasn't been there in the past. And while it's true that the Conan Doyle estate, one of the things they tried to say along the way, there's no legal context for it, but they tried to say was, well, we're supplying quality control. We're doing something important here because we're keeping the riffraff off the street. We're not going to authorize things that we think are low quality. Well, I mean, I understand there may be some benefit to that, but I think my personal view is I'd rather let the readers decide what's low quality than have somebody with a extortionate position.
That's in quotes now.
I'm only quoting the judge. I'd rather have the reader do it. Maybe this will be the end of what I always thought was deplorable, which was the authorized sequel. I hate that idea. I hate the idea that somehow a license holder can put out a product. I wrote a review, and Anthony Horowitz is a lovely person and wrote a good book called The House of Silk, but I was very offended that it was called a, quote, authorized sequel, because I said, look, that's essentially saying this is a licensed fraud. This is not a story by Conan Doyle, but we're going to tell you that it's a story by Conan Doyle because it's authorized.
Yeah, it's a whole industry, isn't it? There's a lot of writers that sometimes they have actually left notes, sketches, even outlines for stories. And I think that that's a different matter from someone who makes a story up from whole cloth. But some of them are quite good.
Yes, indeed. I would hope, and I have, this is the first Lori's going to hear this, but assuming that In the Company of Sherlock Holmes actually does reasonably well, I'm encouraged to the point of thinking that we had enough friends who said, darn, I really wish I could have participated, that maybe we should be doing a third volume.
Are you proposing to me, Les?
Of course.
Well, if you're willing to do all the work as you have in the past too, sure.
Well, that's hardly the case. Now, in fact, we should talk about that because I always point this out. We have divided the responsibilities for these anthologies in what to me is a very logical way, which is I've done sort of the businessy parts of it and read the stories from a technical standpoint. Technical meaning, are they consistent with what we know about Sherlock Holmes from the canon? If they're not, does the writer know that, and is that intentional? And that's fine. I mean, nobody says you have to be absolutely canonical. But when it comes to the story editing, I have always deferred to Lori, and she has been the voice presenting to these amazing authors. Gee, have you thought about possibly changing this sentence over here? I always thought that was the sound course, since I'm not exactly known as a writer of fiction.
Yeah, there are some of the authors in both collections that I was very, very hesitant to make any suggestions whatsoever, and so we are always deferred to their choice all the time. But there would be places where, and I think some of those were yours less, but there were some places where we would think, if you were to shift your storyline just a little this way, it would add a dimension to the reading experience. And I think that's the job of editors beyond just tidying up the grammar and punctuation. And we have tried to do that. Most of the stories haven't required much of that at all, because these are very, very good writers. Every so often there will be something that the author will have simply overlooked that one of us will spot and say, what about? And it's always exciting to see what one of the writers does with that. I mean, I'm not an editor, and I make no pretension of being a New York class editor. I am a writer and I am a reader. And sometimes I get that sense that of what a good editor must feel when they have an influence on a finished product. It's a thrill to see what writers will do with some mild suggestion. They say, yes, yes, and run with it.
And Lori does that very, very well. And I try and, even if they're my comments, I want Lori to present them.
Yeah.
So, Lori, what's coming up? There's another Russell in the pipeline. What comes out next, and what are you working on?
Dreaming Spies is the new Russell. It's out in February 2015. Is it number 12 or 13? I can't remember. Yes. Anyway, it's forging on into the new era of 1925.
You're making such rapid progress.
I know.
Years.
I know. I fit. Was it 8 books in 1924, and here it is. Only the second book, and we're already in April. So this 1925 is flying just like lightning. Anyway, yes, it is a book that actually has 3 settings in it. I had originally intended to write this as a book set in Japan in 1924, because a couple of the books make reference to a case that they worked for the Emperor of Japan as they passed from India to San Francisco in The Game and Locked Rooms.
Did you have any idea what that was about when you wrote that, or did you say, someday I'll get to that?
Not a clue, which is why they doesn't say anything in either of the references, except that it was cold in Japan and that they'd been working there for about 3 weeks. So some friends and I, the owners of the Poison Pen bookstore in Scottsdale, Barbara and Rob Peters-Rosenwald, we went to Japan for 3 weeks a couple years ago. And after that, I could write the book, because when it comes to writing place, I find that research only takes me so far. I need to really see the place in order to make sense of it. So I had intended this book to be a Japan book, but I realized that part of the problem was that there were 2 problems. One of them was they had to get from India to Japan. And that left me with about 3 weeks of downtime. So I thought, well, what if they meet the case on board this ship and then actually work it when they're in Japan? And that worked a lot better. So I have a lot of stuff set on shipboard, which was fun, because I don't do cruises. And so that I had to sort of scramble to do that research. And the other problem was that this was then entirely a flashback of 1924. And I was now chronologically in 25. So what if I were to make the problem that they worked for the Emperor of Japan in the spring of 1924 come back and bite them on the ass in 1925? So that's what happens. They get back to England in 1925 and find that the case they thought they had finished so tidily hasn't quite been entirely finished. And so there's these 3 sections. The first one is on board the ship, the second one is in Japan, and the third one is in Oxford in a year later. But they all kind of regard this, well, they certainly regard the same thing, which is a book of poetry describing the Nakasendo Road by Basho and illustrated by Hiroshige.
What cruise line are they on?
In 1924, the cruise lines in the South Pacific were very iffy, so it's not really a cruise.
That's too bad. There's such wonderful ships in that era.
Yeah, but most of them were Atlantic. They had a few round-the-world cruises going in the 20s. There didn't happen to be any that coincided with when I needed it, and they tended to have stops in places that I didn't want to get distracted by in the plot. So I made it more of a practical steamer that had a few luxuries for passengers.
So the proverbial sort of slow boat to China, yes.
Yeah. It's not, you know, not strictly a steamer that was taking three passengers, but their number of passengers was not large, and the amount of luxury is nowhere near what you would find on a cross-Atlantic trip.
So that book's done, so you're already bored with it. What are you working on?
The one that I'm working on next is called Career Day, and that will be out in probably April of 2016. I'm working my way back around the calendar to be an April publication rather than September, which I've been for the last few years.
This sounds like a Martinelli.
It is actually a standalone. It is based around half a dozen short stories that I've done over the years, all of them centered around a middle school in a fictionalized version of the town that I lived in when my kids were growing up, Watsonville. And it is a career day at the middle school, so that you bring in all these different characters to talk about their jobs and how they trained and what the advantages are. It's the sort of thing that a lot of different people in very various different jobs have done at times in their career. And as you can imagine, writers get dragged in regularly, although I stopped doing them because I realized I didn't want to encourage kids to become writers, because it's really a pipe dream, kids. It's, you know, don't give up your day job.
Is this a mystery, or is it in the genre?
It is a crime story. It is a mystery. In fact, it's a thriller based around these six stories that whose characters appear at this middle school's career day.
Sounds exciting.
My sister is thrilled about it. She's so excited about it.
I meant to ask you, and this is way out of order, but a question earlier about, you know, there's a famous story about Conan Doyle when he decided to chuck it all. He was no longer going to be a doctor, and he was going to be a writer. Was there a moment for you like that where you said, as many of us wish we could, I am a writer. This is what I do full time. This is my day job, my night job. It's what I am.
Yeah, although, you know, there are both disadvantages and advantages to being a kept woman, to having a husband who has the job in the family. For a number of years, I was a stay-at-home mom. Then we had a 2-acre farm, and so being a stay-at-home mom meant that I was in charge of raising all the kinds of stuff that went onto the table and raising the kids and the rest of it. Now, at a certain point, I would have been forced to actually go out and get a job when the kids were in school full time, et cetera. Very fortunately, I managed to sell my first book before the kids were really off my hands on a full-time basis. So it meant that I could point to these paltry little checks that I was getting at first and say, yes, but I'm employed. I have to do this. And it was hard to argue with somebody who actually is being paid to do something. But when I first sold the book and I that the following spring made out the kids' emergency cards for school. For the first time, I could put down, instead of housewife there, I could put down writer. And at that point, I thought, okay, I'm here. I'm never going to give this up. And I have been very, very fortunate in that I haven't had to.
Recently, you appeared at a bookstore, and there was a debate about the difference between a mystery and a thriller. And I really wish that had been recorded, and I was wondering, what was the consensus on that question?
Are you asking about the event at the...
At Kepler's.
At Kepler's. I thought maybe it was the one where I insulted to his face Tom Rob Smith, but that wasn't.
Oh, that's okay. That would be. Yeah.
Tell us that story, by all means.
Tell us that story.
It was one of those things that, you know, the audience thinks that the two people on the dais are having an argument because they can't see that the two people on the dais are sort of grinning at each other behind their hands. So I basically said, you know, thrillers bore me. And he said, well, why did they invite me to this conference if thrillers are boring? Because I write thrillers. And so the two of us squabbled for a while, and people were thinking, oh, my God, the two authors are going to come to blows. But, you know, it was cool. I think that any genre that depends too much on structure is dangerous for a writer, because you tend to focus exclusively on that structure. When you are writing, for example, a classic mystery, a whodunit, it is very easy to get so wrapped up in the presentation of clues and the suspects and the machinery of how the plot turns that you never allow your characters, your place, and your meaning to come to life. I think much as Agatha Christie has going for her, most of the time she was only interested in the machinery of her plots. And I think to the modern taste, that's a hazard, because you tend to have a very clever but rather shallow emotionally story. And I think thrillers are the same case, that you have the thriller structure that turns around thrill. It turns around the timing and the pressure. You probably already know who done it or who is going to do it. And the whole push is, will our hero manage to keep the villain from carrying out his threat or whatever is the plot? And you can get so wrapped up in that, the mechanics of tension, that you lose sight of caring about the characters. So that's what I was saying in the shorthand of thrillers are boring. Because if it's only about the plot, I find myself just kind of whipping through and saying, okay, does anyone I care about die here? Because otherwise it's not really worth it. So that to me is what the main point of the crime and the thriller genre is not just the cleverness of the plot, but getting the reader so wrapped up in the lives of the people, not only the good guys, but the bad guys as well, that the reader really cares. And the thrill is because the reader cares what happens to these people, not just will the writer manage to, you know, keep the pressure on until the last page.
You want the readers to become invested in the characters and care.
Yeah, and if they don't feel that these characters are worth an emotional involvement, then the book really hasn't done much for me. I mean, looking at, I am not going to name names here, But looking at the bestseller list, this is obviously not always true. A lot of people clearly are not that invested in characters. They like the story, they like the push, but to them, it's the cleverness of the story. To me, that's not enough.
Your points are very. I'm sitting here thinking about Conan Doyle, and that this is not. With all due credit, Laurie, I was just going to say that it's not a new idea, and it's an idea that Conan Doyle, I'm not sure he got it. On the one hand, his stories did have such interesting characters, not just Holmes and Watson. Every figure in his stories is a fascinating human being whom we care about or hate want to read about. He expressed that he was bored with thinking up new ideas.
Yeah.
And he ultimately recycled his own ideas and wrote two or three stories with similar plots. He wasn't thinking deep thoughts about the genre, but I think others did. And he was certainly an inspiration for a lot of people in doing that, in writing stories about people that the readers actually cared about.
I mean, it is interesting to look at the Conan Doyle stories because on the surface, they seem to be about a thinking machine and how offensive he is to the rest of the world. I mean, basically, he just insults everybody. I'm writing a serial, a set of journals that I'm posting online that is in 1914. And it's during the period where the Valley of Fear is being serialized. And it starts with this just really offensive exchange where Holmes basically insults Watson in a whole string of ways. And you think, why would I regard this man as a friend? But having established their deep respect and relationship before the Valley of Fear, I think that he could get away with it in a way that he couldn't have if he'd published that story 20 years earlier.
Now, you have had one cross in your Universe-eye, the book called Art of Detection, in which essentially, in an interesting way, Martinelli meets Mary Russell and Sherlock Holmes. Do you think of this as all one large universe, and do you see other parts where they might touch?
People often ask if I'll manage to get, for example, the chronologically closer Russell and the Stuyvesant series. I just don't think that the two of them have a lot of overlap other than chronology. They're coming from such different places as a writer that I think it would be, to use the British term, twee. Overly sweet to try and bring the universes together.
Maybe just in the background, not even naming the characters, just sort of there they are in the distance, at the same dock, at the same city, whatever.
I'll do it somewhere just for you, Les.
Thank you. I mean, of course, Michael Connelly is one who has done this in a sort of very subtle way in the beginning and now becoming more overt about it. There were little characters who'd show up in a book, 15 years ago, who suddenly showed up again in another book.
Yeah. He's really bringing his different universes together, isn't he?
It's tempting. It's what the fans want because we have all of our characters, everybody's characters in one universe.
Yeah, I think that if you're writing either historically or contemporary series, if there is a realistic bent to that series, there's no reason why there can't be an overlap.
Mary Russell meets Jack Reacher. Think of the possibilities.
Kate Martinelli could meet Jack Reacher.
Yeah, well, Mary's around. I mean, Reacher would have to go to London or to England at this point, I guess. So.
Well, she is 114 years old.
I know. I said she's around. I mean, she was around for us to interview for a study in Sherlock.
And, yeah. We probably should mention that if you are interested in a Les meets Laurie in the fictional universe, the first two chapters of Beekeeper's Apprentice have been annotated by none other than Leslie S. Klinger.
And Laurie King,
and a couple of the readers who know it better than I do. And we put it into the Mary Russell Companion, which is an ebook. So that's fun. I mean, it's always fun to do stuff like that with buddies like Les.
Well, it's fun for the fans and the readers as well. It gives us more to look forward to while we wait for the next Mary Russell.
Sorry, 6 months.
Great. All right. Well, thanks, Lori. Have a great day, everybody.
I enjoyed every minute.
Our next interview is with James R. Benn, whose The Rest is Silence, the ninth novel in his Billy Boyle series of World War II mysteries, was released on September 2nd. Since the novel is already out, I'm going to do my best to publish Speaking of Mysteries interview with him before the end of this week. This is Nancy Clare. Thank you again for listening to this episode of Speaking of Mysteries.